You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Warning, speed bump. The deep freeze holding thousand-year-old carbon is thawing faster. The Arctic tosses gigatons of CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, but that hasn't been counted so far. The newest permafrost science with Christina Schadl, senior research scientist at the Woodwell Climate Research Center in Massachusetts. Strangely, the third worst warming gas may become less serious as the world heats up. Atmospheric scientist Michael Prather with sort of good news on nitrous oxide. Satellites reveal global algae is expanding in new places. Is that good or bad? We asked Dr. Brian Barnes from the University of South Florida about the latest science. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. You got three interviews, no time to waste. Let's go. To stay below a dangerous 2 degrees hotter climate, or at least to have half a chance at it, we can't emit much more greenhouse gas. Here's just one big reason why. Previous estimates did not count growing carbon dioxide and methane leaking out of the Arctic. The deep freeze, holding thousands of years of carbon up there, is thawing. Permafrost has several pathways into the sky. Extreme northern wildfires in recent years made it worse. Christina Schadl is lead author of the new paper published January 24, 2026. She was trained as a biogeochemist and plant ecophysiologist at the University of Basel. Christina is now senior research scientist at Woodwell Climate Research Center in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Christina Schadl, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So, as an introduction, how much carbon is locked up in the frozen north, and how much of that is leaking out into the atmosphere?
There's a lot of carbon in permafrost right now, and I find it helpful to think of it as permafrost contains about twice as much carbon as is currently contained in the atmosphere. The atmosphere has about 800 to 850 gigatons of carbon currently, and even that number doesn't mean that much to people. So I think the best really is to say the number is really big, and what is more important is that we have about twice as much carbon as in the atmosphere in permafrost right now. And we estimate that to be about 1,400 to 1,600 petagrams of carbon that are stored in permafrost. And there are some less well-quantified carbon pools in really deep sediments and subsea permafrost that would increase that number even more, but they are poorly quantified, so they are not included in this estimate. And given how big this carbon pool in permafrost is right now, even if only a very small portion of that is being released to the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide and methane, it will really add a substantial amount of carbon to the atmosphere just because the pool itself is so big.
So let's figure this out. In past ages, there was a warmer world. There was almost tropical life right up to the Arctic Sea. And then the plant life somehow froze, and now it's coming back into the air as a greenhouse gas. Talk us through that long process at work here. How did it happen?
Yes. Permafrost is, by definition, frozen ground that stays frozen for at least two consecutive years. But most areas of permafrost are actually frozen for thousands of years. So that definition is a little misleading if it just says 2 years. And permafrost contains soil, rock, organic matter, and ice. And because it is frozen ground, it acts like a giant freezer. Things don't rot or decompose while they're in the frozen state or at a very, very slow pace. And the unique feature about permafrost is that it contains so much organic material, meaning it's dead biomass of partially decomposed plants and animal inputs that got frozen into the ground thousands of years ago. And some of that organic material is really, really old. As I said, thousands of years old. And as long as permafrost stays frozen, it's relatively inert, and only the upper layer close to the surface will thaw during the summer months and then refreeze again, We call that active layer because it's active during the growing season, but it's not the actual permafrost. And then temperatures in the Arctic are warming about four times as fast as the rest of the world, and that means that the ground doesn't stay frozen as much anymore. And we have observations that clearly show that permafrost temperatures have strongly increased across the entire Arctic by multiple degrees. And in many places, that means that the soil is thawing. So it's changing from frozen to unfrozen. One can think of this like food that was stored in your freezer. And when you take it out, and even if you put it in your fridge, it will start to thaw and decompose slowly. And the same thing happens with the organic material that's frozen in permafrost. Once it is no longer frozen all year round, it starts to thaw and the microbes wake up and start decomposing that organic material. And with that process, they release carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere.
In 2019, permafrost expert Merit Turetsky told us large climate models that were used to advise governments did not include carbon dioxide and methane coming from thawing Arctic lands. Is this important source of carbon included now in newer models like CMIP-6?
The answer is complicated, but partially yes. There has been improvement in CMIP-6 models compared to previous versions, but those models that are included in IPCC assessment reports, in the 6th assessment report, only 2 out of the 11 models that were included for climate projections included a representation of permafrost carbon. So that's a relatively small number or a small percentage of the models. And then both of these models have the same land component, so there was very little diversity in how permafrost carbon processes were represented. And neither of these models included complex disturbance processes such as abrupt thaw or wildfire interactions. So far, models only include the gradual top-down thawing. And the next coupled model intercomparison project, CMIP-7, is underway, and some things will be improved, but disturbance processes will still not be part of those model runs.
Yes, those unusual processes. Merit told us about that. I mean, we expect Arctic thaw to be a slow process, taking at least hundreds and likely thousands of years. But some patches of permafrost thaw quickly, and we need to recognize emissions from abrupt thaw. What are your thoughts on the timescale of emissions?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the important thing here is also to recognize that because it is a slow process, and the slow part does refer to the gradual top-down thawing mostly, it takes a while to get going, but then also once it has started, it doesn't immediately stop either. Again, once temperatures don't increase much anymore, it will not mean that permafrost thawing and carbon release stops right away because it is that slow process. And another important thing to note is that any of the carbon that has been released from or will be released from permafrost to the atmosphere, it will not come back into the soil anytime soon. So it's a largely irreversible process. And then in regard to abrupt thaw, the important thing here is that we are already seeing some of these abrupt thaw features currently. They were expected to happen, but further out in the future, and now they're already happening now. And in some areas, the ground doesn't fully refreeze anymore during the winter, which then means microbial decomposition continues throughout the winter, and that adds even more emissions to the atmosphere. Yeah, these abrupt processes are real. They're happening right now, and we anticipate large emissions from these abrupt processes.
Well, do you think emissions from permafrost thaw overall is right now or soon will be significant? Is there an urgency to this?
Yeah, there's absolutely an urgency to reduce warming, and not just for permafrost thaw. There are many, many aspects of climate change that really require high urgency for action. It's important to note that permafrost emissions do not dwarf anthropogenic emissions, meaning they're not larger than all anthropogenic emissions together, but they are similar in size to the emissions of a large industrialized nation. And how big they are does depend on the emissions pathways that we are headed towards the end of 2100. Right now, these emissions from permafrost are not accounted for in carbon budget calculations. So we are not actually accounting for all of the sources of emissions. And you can think of this like planning a meal without really understanding all the ingredients. You will end up with a meal that does not taste quite right because you did not include all the ingredients that are needed to be included. But unlike for a meal, missing a temperature target has big global consequences that are felt for decades.
Can we measure permafrost emissions in real time, say by satellites or a mass network of robotic sensors?
That's a very tough challenge because the Arctic is so vast and cold and very remote. So it's hard to measure permafrost emissions in many locations throughout the year consecutively. And then costs and logistics for anything like that are immense. And so that does not exist. There are efforts underway to provide at least annual updates of carbon emissions from permafrost, and these numbers will be coming from multiple but not that many locations across the Arctic. And even for those emissions, it takes a little bit of time to process the data. So you're not getting emission data from one day to the next day, but hopefully we can get emission data soon per year. And the challenge there is, it involves many different groups from many different institutions and countries. They all have different data sharing policies. There's a lot of QA, a lot of quality control of the data that is needed. And so it's just, there will always be a little bit of a lag.
As you said, the Arctic is warming four times faster than the global average. So plants will benefit. Some will move north, capturing more carbon. Could added plant growth offset extra carbon leaking from the permafrost?
Yes, to some extent, that is possible. We know that plants benefit from warmer temperatures, and we know that they can grow bigger and further north if the conditions are right. But warmer temperatures are not the only thing that plants need to grow. They also need nutrients and water, and plants take some time to grow as well. They don't just grow much bigger within 2 years or move north within 2 years. That takes multiple years. And the change right now is happening so strongly. In many areas in the Arctic, we do see greening, so that means enhanced plant growth, but we also see areas where plants die, and that's called browning. That can be because of disturbance processes or droughts in the Arctic or other causes. And so the assumption is that plants will offset some of the carbon that is being released through increased decomposition, but overall the increased respiration, the decomposition part will be larger, especially because the cold season is getting shorter and warmer, and so there will be more carbon release throughout the cold season.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Christina Schadl, tell us about connections between wildfires and permafrost emissions.
Yeah, so obviously wildfires burn above ground biomass. We can see that with our own eyes when we see that a tree has burned. But the other part, the connection to permafrost, is also that wildfires can burn the highly organic surface layer that protects the layers underneath, and so that organic layer acts as an insulator, and when it is gone, much warmer air temperature can directly penetrate deep into the ground, thawing more soil that will lead to more carbon release. These deeper layers may be better protected from warming because it takes a while for them to warm up, but if that insulation is gone, the suddenly warm air temperature can suddenly get really into deep layers, and that's a connection between wildfire and permafrost thawing that hasn't been accounted for in models so far.
So we have at least three factors adding greenhouse gases in the far north. There is gradual thaw, abrupt thaw, and wildfire changes. How do these measure up in terms of emissions, and do they interact like feedback loops?
Yes, they do interact. The gradual thaw is a slow, steady release as soils warm over time. Abrupt thaw affects smaller areas, but it releases carbon much faster and often with more methane involved. So it packs a higher warming impact early on. And then wildfires release a lot of CO2 right away, but they do take away that insulation of the soil, which warms the ground and then further accelerates gradual and particularly abrupt thaw afterwards. So all the processes are linked together, and fire makes thaw worse and increases carbon emissions earlier.
What happens when we add abrupt thaw and wildfire changes to those previous estimates that were used by most institutions of just the slow thaw?
When we include abrupt and wildfire emissions to the gradual thaw emissions, we increase the total emissions from the permafrost region by 170 to 260% compared to just gradual emissions alone. So it's important to also account for these emissions. Otherwise, we are ignoring a massive contribution of carbon dioxide or methane to the atmosphere.
For a realistic plan to keep warming below 2 degrees C, experts calculate the amount of carbon we could still release. Now, how do these previously unaccounted permafrost emissions change the budget for a 50% chance of staying below 2 degrees C?
Yeah, accounting for permafrost emissions really shrinks the remaining carbon budget by about 17% to avoid a 2-degree climate target. So that's about 1/6 of the remaining carbon budget that goes directly towards permafrost emissions. And so it's taken away from what human emissions can be.
It seems human aspirations, at least officially, go up to 2100 and stop. Is permafrost thaw an unstoppable process like some glaciers melting? How long could permafrost thaw continue to add more warming to the atmosphere?
Permafrost emissions will go on for a very long time and continue for hundreds of years. We do have model simulations that go way beyond 2100, but it is often hard to communicate the urgency of something if the year we are using is way beyond our current human lifetime. Like, no, none of us right now will still be alive at 2300. So it's really hard to communicate the urgency if we're talking about a time point that's far in the future. But we do expect permafrost emissions to continue for a very long time.
In 2020, another of your co-authors, Susan Natale, told us permafrost doesn't just add greenhouse gases in the Arctic summer. Winter emissions are real and increasing, and you mentioned that. Did your new team's modeling include this?
Yeah, it's important to know that the model that we are used for this study is a reduced complexity Earth system model, which means it doesn't simulate seasonal or monthly changes. We only get annual values, and they include the temperature, respiration process throughout the whole year. And emissions are therefore directly modeled by temperature. And that means winter emissions are sort of included, but not directly distinguishable from growing season emissions. That's why this model runs much, much faster.
Well, this sounds like a lot of new carbon from the far north, some of it highly warming methane. Do we know how much warming to expect from the permafrost source alone?
Yeah, global warming is directly proportional to cumulative carbon emissions. It's quite the linear relationship. And the challenge is to get a direct number from warming because it depends on the warming trajectories and the ratio of CO2 and methane, and those are things that are not entirely solved yet. But right now, we expect about 0.05 to 0.23 degrees Celsius warming just from permafrost by 2100. And because every tenth of a degree matters, it's important to note here again that this warming is in addition to fossil and land use emissions that are caused by warming.
Your new paper shows models and estimates for permafrost thaw seriously underestimate the emissions we're really putting up there, and this changes the promises made to avoid 2 degrees of warming and lowers the amount of carbon left supposedly to burn. But I've got to be frank, after 30 COP climate conferences and emissions are still growing, the process has kind of failed. How would you interpret this paper's results and language to communicate your findings to climate activists, the public, to our listeners? What is your message here?
That's a great question, and it is a challenge we face daily. I do want to say that there is no such thing, really, as how much carbon can we safely burn. These temperature goals under the Paris Agreement, 1.5 and 2 degrees, they don't really have a physical meaning, but they are useful for setting targets, and that's what you need for setting emissions goals in the policy landscape. So the best is to keep warming to the lowest number possible. And if we surpass 1.5 degrees, which we most likely will, the next the next best target would be 1.6 degrees warming or even less. It's not 2 degrees Celsius. That's still way too far. And there's not a magic threshold that changes everything, but it's a policy-relevant goal. And the message from this paper is that warming-driven emissions, which is what permafrost emissions are, as well as wildfire emissions, they eat into that remaining carbon budget and reduce how much we have left. That means the remaining human emissions to stay below 1.5 or 2 degrees are much smaller than we have previously estimated. And in other words, permafrost and wildfire emissions don't change the temperature goal. They change how fast we must cut emissions to reach them. And that's a strong message, but a tough one to deal with because it requires even stricter emission reductions.
In my opinion, a possible methane seeping from the Arctic seabed gets more attention than actual greenhouse gases escaping right now from the permafrost. Why isn't this getting enough attention? Is there a save the permafrost or maybe watch out for the permafrost kind of activism?
I have also noticed that there is more attention for massive methane release from the Arctic. And my thinking is that it is a story that's easy to sell and that grabs attention. But what we are really concerned about are the continuous emissions from permafrost that will not stop very quickly. And I think the best safe to permafrost activism is to reduce global emissions.
What is the permafrost carbon network?
The permafrost carbon network is an international research network that coordinates and synthesizes data and knowledge on permafrost carbon, mostly on how much carbon is there, what are the mechanisms for releasing carbon as methane or carbon dioxide. And it's a very interdisciplinary community of permafrost and carbon cycle scientists. It includes people that take measurements in the field. It also includes modeling teams. And the focus really has been on quantifying the permafrost carbon feedback to climate change.
Christina, your degrees are from the University of Basel and your early work is in plant physiology. What drew you into a study of permafrost and climate change in the Arctic?
It's been a while now that I started working on permafrost, and I got the opportunity to do a postdoc that focused on permafrost and coordinating the permafrost carbon network. And when I started that position, I knew very little about permafrost, even though I had been to Alaska before. And once I started working on the topic, I realized how important it is in the global context and how much we don't know. And now, about 15 years later, I would say we know a lot more. And mostly the message is that we must act faster to reduce the impacts on the Arctic. And I want to give a shout out to all of my fabulous colleagues who have really helped shape the permafrost carbon network and bring in a lot of resources and enthusiasm to advance the knowledge.
From the Woodwell Climate Research Center, we've been speaking with Dr. Christina Schadl. She is lead author of the new study, Permafrost and Wildfire Carbon Emissions Indicate Need for Additional Action to Keep Paris Agreement Temperature Goals Within Reach. Find links to follow up in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Christina, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You know about carbon dioxide and methane heating up the planet. Can you name the number three worst greenhouse gas? It is potent, long-lived, and a significant ozone killer. The global warming potential of nitrous oxide is nearly 300 times greater than carbon dioxide over 100 years. But for once, new science is not worse than we thought. Can you handle a little good news? When estimates for this gas were uncertain, scientist Michael Prather worked to nail down warming from nitrous oxide. Dr. Prather is professor of Earth System Science at University of California, Irvine. He specializes in atmospheric chemistry and published over 200 peer-reviewed papers and articles. From Irvine, California, Michael Prather, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleased to join you, Alex.
We can't see this gas, and strangely, inhaling it makes us laugh. What is nitrous dioxide? Sorry, what is nitrous oxide?
Nitrous oxide, yes. Nitrous oxide is an interesting, fairly inert compound, and inert compounds seem safe because they're not directly poisonous, although if you inhale too much nitrous oxide, you'll become asphyxiated and dead. But basically, those compounds tend to be long-lived. They accumulate in the atmosphere. You don't need to emit too much of it. You don't need to have too much leakage, and it starts lasting. And typically, if you throw a molecule in the atmosphere, it lasts about 100 years.
According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, how important is nitrous oxide to heating up the planet?
Well, nitrous oxide is the number three. Originally, it was chlorofluorocarbons that were number three, because they were, but we've started eliminating emissions of those. So in terms of emissions, the nitrous oxide really is sort of like the number three component, sitting below methane and then sitting below carbon dioxide. The global warming potential is 300 times larger, which sounds huge, but of course, we really only emit about 1% or less of nitrous oxide compared to the amount of CO2 we emit. So you have to scale those GWP numbers by sort of the scale of the industry.
And how do we put this up, we humans? How do we get the nitrous oxide into the atmosphere?
Well, once you make it, it's hard not to get it out. There are a few bugs that eat it if it's in the soil, but not many. It's not that, shall we say, delightful to eat or easy to eat, unlike some other compounds. Methane is much easier, for example, for the bugs to eat in the soil. But nitrous oxide, once you make it, tends to sort of bubble to the surface and get out. We make it primarily, we used to make it industrially through processes involving nitrogen, like making nitric acid, adipic acid, or industrial compounds. But right now, it's mostly agricultural. We fix nitrogen to make fertilizer, huge amounts of nitrogen, and then we put it on our fields. And then when the nitrogen is being decomposed in the soil, some of that decomposition goes into the plants for growth, which is why we fertilize them. But some of it forms nitrous oxide, then bubbles out. So right now, probably the biggest sources, the most growing sources, are agriculture-related, between fertilizer and agricultural waste handling from large cattle feedlots and other related things. Also will be a source of nitrous oxide.
So we track the amount of carbon dioxide in the air daily at Mauna Loa Observatory, and the second biggest warming gas, methane, gets a lot of press and a lot of groups studying it. Why do you think, Michael, that nitrous oxide has been kind of neglected and less known to the public?
Interesting question. I don't know why. I mean, sort of like, why do the forces of science decide to focus on one thing and not another? Sometimes it's logical, sometimes it's availability. The reason why methane is really hot now is there's so many different ways that you can measure it from space remotely. You see methane sources sort of bubbling out of regions, with satellites now. And nitrous oxide, we don't really have that capability. And I'm not sure we will. It's a much tougher gas to measure than methane. And so there's a lot of interest in methane. And it is, again, more important than N2O and an overall greenhouse effect. But the methane is also of interest because it's short-lived, and if we can tamp it down, it will disappear in a decade or two. Whereas nitrous oxide, we're there for years, like the chlorofluorocarbons. It's a long-lived compound. Once we emit it, we can't really get it back.
A key factor in warming potential of greenhouse gases is how long do they stay up there? Carbon dioxide lasts thousands of years, but methane's potential, as you say, it starts to decline after only about 10 years. In 2015, you led a paper suggesting a lifetime number for nitrous oxide. What did you find then, and what is the consensus in science before your latest paper?
Well, the 2015 paper was the one where we merged atmospheric measurements and about three different photochemical models of the atmosphere to try to understand what we think the lifetime is, derived from both the observations and derived from the models, sort of ab initio physics. And we found that, in general, it was pretty close. It was in 10-20%. And the models would calculate an N2O lifetime of maybe 130 years, and we're getting about 110 on the satellite data sets. So it was not so far off. And the patterns look good. The ability to model nitrous oxide to compare with the structures we see in the stratosphere is quite good. So I'd say that's become sort of the gold standard in terms of lifetimes. And now it's really, most it's like about 115 years, 120 years are the numbers that are being used by the assessments.
In your later work, it seems to me you look at nitrous oxide persistence differently. Is it fair to say you now recommend a kind of sliding scale for nitrous oxide lifetime?
Sliding scale is always an interesting question. I think the nitrous oxide lifetime is changing.